welcome to always take notes.
If you're a budding writer, you'll be excited to hear that this week's sponsors are Curtis Brown Creative, the renowned writing school run by the major literary and talent agency.
Since launching in 2011, over 190 of their students have gone on to get major book deals, including critically acclaimed authors Bonnie Garmus, Amelia Hart, Jenny Quintana, and Sean Lusk.
CBC offers a wide range of inspiring courses that give writers practical advice and demystify the publishing industry. If you have a complete first draft of a novel, and this week's episode leaves you feeling inspired to get your manuscript ready to submit to literary agents, their best-selling Edit and Pitch Your Novel course is for you.
This six-week online course includes exclusive teaching videos presented by CBC's founder Anna Davis and agents from the top UK literary agencies, Curtis Brown and C&W. Plus, all students have the opportunity to get feedback from one of CBC's expert editors.
If you're ready to raise your writing game with an online course, there is an exclusive discount for Always Take Notes listeners. Use the code ATN20 for £20 off the full price of Edit and Pitch Your Novel or any other 4, 5, or 6 week online course. Visit www.curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. Hello and welcome to Always Take Notes. In this episode, we spoke with Francesca Main, publisher of Phoenix Books.
We spoke to Francesca about her experience working at Penguin, Simon & Schuster and Picador, about publishing the smash hits The Miniaturist and This Is Going to Hurt, and about setting up Phoenix Books, a new imprint at Hachette.
It's a great episode and we hope you enjoy it. Francesca, welcome to Always Take Notes. It's excellent to have you on the podcast. We wanted to start with your move to Orion in 2021 to set up a new imprint, Phoenix Books, specialising in, and I quote here, fiction and memoir with literary merit and commercial potential. How did that move come about?
Hello, thanks for having me. Well, the short answer is that I was approached by Katie Espiner, who was then MD of Orion and is now MD of both Orion and Hodder, and asked to do it, which was obviously a great privilege and something that was very hard to say no to. The slightly longer answer is that I had been at Picador for 8 years, where I had been very happy, planned to stay for much longer, and had built up a list of writers that I felt very proud of and very connected to. But I had reached the point in my career that I think lots of people get to in publishing and in other creative industries, where the next step up is going to be the step that takes you away from some of the reasons you got into it in the first place. And that had come to a head for me quite recently because my boss at the time, the head of our imprint, had left quite suddenly and the succession music started playing. And there were conversations about, who was going to take over the leadership of the imprint. And a number of people, including Katie Espiner, encouraged me to throw my hat into the ring and to go for it. And, I felt very grateful for all the people who took time to give me advice or mentoring, because my immediate response was, oh my God, no, I can't do this. I was working 4 days a week with a one-year-old at home and already feeling very overstretched and didn't know if I had it in me. And it was nice to be encouraged out of some of that imposter syndrome and encouraged to think about it more seriously, and particularly as a woman, to be encouraged not to feel like you can only go for a job if you know everything about it and how you would achieve everything already. But the more I had those conversations, the more I realized that it wasn't something that I wanted to do. I didn't want to take a further step into management. I didn't want to do something that would mean, looking after some of my authors and continuing to edit some of my books, but actually having a role that was taking me away from the amount of editing and author collaboration and commissioning and hands-on publishing that I love to do. And whilst I was facing this decision about, which next step to take, Katie came along with an offer that was impossible to say no to, which seemed like a way to me of kind of future-proofing being an editor. So being able to do something that felt like a new challenge and a step up, but also to remain very focused on the things that I love to do, which is commissioning and editing and working with my colleagues to make books happen and bring books to readers.
So what's the size of the team at Phoenix? And are you doing some management now, or is it still mostly editorial focused?
It's very small. It's basically me, and I share an assistant who I hope will continue to grow and take on more responsibility over time. So there isn't, I mean, there's management involved because it's a leadership position. I mean, I'm the sole publisher for the imprint. So my job is not only to work with my writers, but also have a strategy for the list and be an ambassador for the list and develop a kind of an imprint and a brand that is only at the beginning of its life. And there's lots of management. I don't know if there's a sort of technical name for it. The managing is not all the people under you who report to you and you're doing their appraisals and setting their goals and all of that kind of thing. But there's management in a different way, because so much of an editor or a publisher's job is a project management job of making sure everything's on track and people have the information they need and things are being, you know, deadlines are being met and the books are getting the focus they deserve to have. And so there is a huge amount of kind of, I don't know, leadership and management internally. But in terms of the team itself, it's just me and the assistant. I mean, I feel very fortunate that Orion now has a literary division and a commercial division, and Phoenix is part of the literary division alongside Weidenfeld and Nicholson, which is one of our oldest and most established literary imprints, and White Rabbit, which is another sole publisher imprint led by Lee Brackstone. And so I share that editorial meeting, which is great, because otherwise the editorial meeting would be me agreeing with myself and asking the assistant to agree with me. And it means that I get to benefit from all of these brilliant publishers and colleagues. You know, it's such an inspiring team of people at Orion at the moment. I feel like I get to benefit from that every day. And, you know, all I want to do is kind of learn more. I feel like you never stop learning. So I get that and all kinds of other advice, mentoring, support and fun from that wider team. But in terms of managing the imprint, that's all on me.
Is there a difference between British and American publishing in the number of titles a single editor or publisher would be expected to oversee? One thing I'd heard, that editors in London just produce a lot more books, that there's less manpower than there would be in an equivalent role in the States. Is that right? Or
that's quite possibly true. I think it vastly depends on the individual. I do know of plenty of American editors in a similar position to me who might do 6 to 8 books a year. And actually, that's more or less the role that I have managed to carve out for myself, which is a joy, because I personally would much rather be doing fewer books really, really well than being overstretched and late on everything and having some books that were floundering because you weren't giving them enough attention, which is not to say that that is what is happening on the list of people who publish a lot more. I mean, Phoenix is going to grow over the next few years to 10 to 12 titles a year, and that will still be on me with the help that I'm fortunate enough to have. But yeah, and over here, it vastly depends to editors. Some lists are very big and editors are split between lots and lots of titles. Other editors carve out a space like I do where the emphasis is on fewer. But it also, I suppose, depends on the needs of individual projects, like a project where you're the lead publisher and doing lots of hands-on editorial work and lots of, you know, hand selling and, you know, playing your part in taking the author around to bookshops and devising the publicity campaign and working with marketing and all of that kind of thing is a lot more hands-on and labor-intensive than some projects, which is not to say that books that you buy in from other countries don't get edited or don't get, you know, properly resourced. But for editors who are managing much bigger lists, I expect there is a balance between some very hands-on projects and other projects that are bought in from the US, say, and take up less time in some ways.
How much oversight is there of your list from sort of higher ups in the company? Do you have sort of weekly check-ins, monthly check-ins, or are you sort of left to your own devices?
I'm left to my own devices a lot, which is not to say that I can do what I like. I mean, like any editor or publisher, if I find a book that I want to buy, I share it with an editorial team for feedback and advice. For me, I'm in a fortunate enough position where it's not that somebody is saying, you are or aren't allowed to buy that, but I definitely want to hear other people's takes on it. And if people have, you know, come back with feedback that sort of suggests that it isn't something that the company needs or that it's going to work, then I absolutely listen to that. I sort of actively want that feedback. And then from then, as I'm sure other guests have probably explained, a project will be taken forward to an acquisitions meeting and we'll have input from the sales team, marketing team, publicity, rights, the managing director, and it becomes a much more collective decision. So there's still that rigor that goes into the acquisitions process. But I've been fortunate enough to, you know, have a lot of faith and trust and support, and I mean it's up to me to reward that, which is a responsibility that I take very seriously, but it's been sort of down to me to shape the strategy for the list in terms of the shape it takes, the balance between different types of book. I'm sure other people would, you know, have plenty of feedback if the list sort of started to skew too much in one direction or there was, you know, an imbalance in the type of books we were doing. But that's something that I try to weigh up very carefully. And so far, I've been left to get on with it. But we're 3 years in now.
So some of our listeners will be extremely familiar with kind of how publishing works internally, but some also will not. Could you explain, you know, how many submissions are crossing your desk in a typical week or a month, who they're coming from, and then how many of those you acquire?
Yeah, absolutely. So it varies according to the time of year. There are busy periods like the run-up to book fairs where agents want to submit and ideally find UK homes for their books ahead of being able to pitch and sell their books to publishers internationally at the major book fairs, which are the London Book Fair in April each year and the Frankfurt Book Fair in October. So the sort of run up to the London Book Fair can start from January. You just sort of come back bleary eyed after Christmas and new submissions are landing on your desk. And in the run up to Frankfurt is usually a bit more concentrated because around holiday, different editors going on holiday at different times and schools breaking up and all that kind of thing. It's often not a great time for an agent who wants a big response to a project to send it out in the middle of the summer. So from the first week of September onwards can be very busy. And at those busy times, for me personally, I can be receiving 2, 3, sometimes 5 or 6 submissions a day. I mean, it's hard to weigh up against other people. On the one hand, I think I get quite a lot because I publish both fiction and nonfiction, and also because at Orion, agents are allowed to submit to multiple imprints. So at some publishing houses, including places I've worked before, the agent would have to choose an editor in that company to submit to and can only submit to that editor. And if that editor decides to share it with a colleague or turns it down, then they can go again with someone else. But at Orion, you can submit to multiple imprints simultaneously, so long as we all know about it, so we're not unduly competing with each other. And that means that as a standalone imprint, I can see more stuff because they can send it to me alongside any number of other editors. So yeah, those busy times, it could be sort of up to 6 or 7 a day. If it's fiction, the agent will be submitting the whole novel most of the time. If it's nonfiction, it's usually a proposal which will involve a sort of detailed summary of what the work is going to look like and the author's intentions and you know, perhaps a summary of their connections or how they might promote it, how they see it, and then some sample chapters. So it's a lot. And then over the summer is one of the quieter periods, but there are still submissions coming in, maybe 1 or 2 a day at that stage. I've tracked them all on a spreadsheet because otherwise I would have no idea what's going on. And so I usually receive around 400 submissions a year, and that's just submissions from agents. This is often why publishers say that they can't accept unsolicited submissions, just because there are not the hours in the day to be able to consider even all of those submissions from agents, let alone to be able to take on, you know, extra reading outside of that. And as I'm sure others have said, lots of this reading is taking place on the tube whilst you're brushing your teeth, late at night, first thing in the morning, on weekends, sort of all the bits of time you can find around your busy day job. most of the stuff that I take on or take forward does come from agents, but there have been books that I have taken on by approaching a writer or by meeting a writer and following up an idea. So it does happen in other ways, but most often it's submissions from literary agents.
Presumably you have to be pretty ruthless when reading those manuscripts and submissions. How many pages do you give yourself before you decide whether or not you're interested?
Well, I read on a Kindle because it's much more portable. When I first joined publishing and started reading submissions, e-readers weren't a thing. So you used to print out the first, 40, 50 pages of a bunch of different things and lug them all around with you. So having a Kindle makes it much easier. I find it quite boring reading on a Kindle in some ways. Would always choose to read on paper in my spare time. But what I like about reading submissions on a Kindle, apart from it being portable and saving on chiropractors bills, is it's quite leveling. So everything kind of looks the same. It sort of gives everything the same font. And I try to treat it like reading a book that I had downloaded. And I do still read some Kindle books in my spare time. And I try to give everything at least 10%, which maybe doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're having to be ruthless, as you say, then, that's what you have to do. But also 10% is probably about what you would read. You can download a sample of a book from Amazon to decide whether or not you want to buy it. And as much as possible, when I'm reading submissions, I'm trying to think like a reader. One of the questions that increasingly I'm asking myself at the moment, as the cost of living crisis goes on and, book prices rise, is about the books that I want to take on, is would I spend full price of my own money on buying this book in a bookshop? And if the answer is not a truthful yes, then that means something to me, because I don't feel like I can ask the same of readers in bookshops. So I try to give everything 10%. Sometimes you know a lot earlier, and that's not necessarily because the work isn't good. It's had a significant quality filter because everything's coming from literary agents, but so much of it is just knowing that you're not the right reader for something, you don't have the right expertise, it's not a good fit for your list, you've got something too much in that vein already. You've published books like that before and they didn't work, whatever it might be. There's lots of reasons why you might kind of check out early. And then for me, it's also a very instinctive and quite emotive process of like wanting to find a voice that you connect with and a writer you believe in and a story that carries you along. And what I'm really looking for is something that I quite quickly forget it's a submission. And that doesn't have to be because it's incredibly polished and doesn't need lots of work, because I love rolling up my sleeves and doing the work, but just where, it reminds you why you enjoy reading, which is, I don't want to talk to my family or watch TV or go to bed. I just want to find out what happens.
You mentioned one novel in particular to us, The Midnight News by Jo Baker. So the story of a woman during the Blitz in the Second World War. And this is the author's eighth book, but the first one that you've done together. How did you come to acquire that and to be working on it?
Well, that was a case of, I suppose, one door closes and another one opens, in that there was a book that I completely fell in love with, a novel called The Whalebone Theatre, which is a debut novel by a writer called Joanna Quinn. And it just completely blew me away. It was incredibly long. And as a tired person with a small child and all of those submissions to get through, often a long book doesn't fill my heart with joy. But I just sunk into it and didn't want it to end. It's set in Dorset, which is where I grew up. And so even though I did not grow up in a crumbling mansion on a clifftop with aristocratic parents, I know the beaches and the coastline it was set on so well that it gave me that extra sense of, how it all looked and felt and the smell of the sea air. And it's about these three children who find a whalebone carcass on a beach and create a theatre in it because their parents are so kind of drunk and neglectful. They have no idea what they're doing. And it's set just before the Second World War, and it sort of shows their coming of age. And then it shows what happens as war breaks out and the siblings come of age and have to go their own ways. And it was such a joy to read, partly because it felt like childhood reading. It did capture that feeling of just, I want to switch off from the world and remain immersed in this story. But it was also incredibly moving and brilliantly written and so imaginative. Anyway, I completely loved it, and I was the underbidder in the auction for it, which means that I didn't quite pay enough money. I think it was incredibly close, and it was between me and a publisher that I really admire, and we kind of take it in turns to lose books to each other, and she got this one, and I was really sad about it. And then a few weeks later, her agent Claire Alexander emailed me just before I went away and said, I couldn't sell you one, Joe, but perhaps I can sell you another. And she, I think, just sent this book to me. I don't know, I don't think it was entirely rooted in it being a consolation prize of not getting the other Joe, but perhaps because there's a similar quality to their writing, or, you know, there was certain similarities in the story that they were telling, even though the two books are very, very different. Or I don't know what it was, but she was looking for a new home for her other Joe, and sent it to me. And I loved this one too. And I had read two of Joe Baker's novels before, both of them very different. The Body Lies, which is kind of a literary crime novel, and Longbourn, which was her big best-selling novel, which was a very brilliant take on Pride and Prejudice told from the servant's point of view. So I had read and admired her in the past, but there were gaps in my knowledge, and I tried to read this one fresh, and I completely loved it. And, you know, first and foremost, I just desperately wanted to publish it and share it with people. And it was also something that I wanted to do because I had been keen to find some more experienced writers to add to my list at Phoenix, because I had gone from, you know, working at a very well-established literary imprint at Picador, and most of my list there was one that I had built up from scratch. But I had got to the point there where some of the writers that I was working with were on to their second or third or fourth book. But I had also taken on some of the authors who were had been published by Picador for a long time. So I had edited a novel by Emma Donoghue, and I'd been working with Megan Abbott, and there were certain other writers at Picador that I was working with. And both for the balance of the list and my own kind of experience and enjoyment, and, you know, giving kind of both the list and myself as much range as possible, I wanted to find some writers who would bring experience to the list and who were also at a different point in their career, because I think starting an imprint just by publishing debut writers is really difficult. And, you know, you want them to all stand out from each other. You know, one of the things that I love about what I do now is being able to say to writers, you know, this is a very bespoke and hand-selected list, and, you know, you're probably going to be the only book coming out from Phoenix in that month, and it means you get many more opportunities and quite a bit more attention that you might do on a bigger burgeoning list that's full of, you know, celebrated prize winners and people who, you know, take up a lot of the resource. But I can't then pit 6 to 8 debut novelists a year against each other, because that's not going to serve any of them very well either. It's, you know, and it's a different experience and a different challenge sometimes, but also incredibly rewarding to write, to work with a writer who's honed their craft over many books and, you know, is bringing their own experiences of publishing and, you know, writing and lecturing with them, but is also ready for a fresh start. There can be a really nice thing about, you know, them having all of that experience and, you know, a history and a readership, but also you still get to feel like you're in at the beginning of something new together.
You mentioned earlier doing fewer titles so that you can give each one sort of time and attention that it deserves. Could you walk us through what your approach to the editing process is? I mean, how many iterations do you go through? Do you read through it sort of once first, and then do you do a second read with notes? I mean, kind of what are the nuts and bolts of the process for you?
Well, it depends on the writer, and that's one of the things that I like about it. And I try to say to the author at the beginning, you know, I like to work in a way that works for you, in that, you know, I have my own way that I like to do things. But one of the things that I enjoy so much about working with authors is that their, you know, characters, temperaments, creative processes are all very different. And some things, you know, some authors, for example, like enjoy the fact that I'm quite old fashioned and like to edit on the page. Others just want the notes and track changes, and that's fine. And, you know, my job is to kind of serve them to write the best next draft that they can. And that's not just about me sort of doing my best with the notes and trying to kind of embrace their vision for the book so that I can help them to realize their intentions for it and kind of all the noble stuff. It's also about kind of delivering those notes in a format that they can work with, and making that process smoother for them. So I try and be as flexible as possible. I think a lot of the best editing comes through conversation and asking questions. And I also feel like communication is really important. Like, you've got to be on the same page, no pun intended. And your job is not to kind of turn the book into something it's not meant to be, or kind of take your own latent creative writing ambitions and, you know, let them flourish on the page. It's just to help the writer make the book the best possible version of itself. So I usually make sure that we, you know, I want to just sort of be able to read something straight through as a reader. You know, I don't feel like you can kind of fully come up with thoughtful editorial notes sort of if you're reading and trying to edit for the first time, because you need to have the whole thing in your head and you need to, you know, first and foremost come to it as a reader and like have an instinctive and emotive reaction to it. So first of all, you know, I like to just have a really good chat to make sure that kind of almost sense check my response to the work with what they were trying to do, and, you know, have a long conversation about what they're doing. That's also, I find, a really important stage if you're about to take on a writer whose book you think needs any kind of, you know, more significant work than punctuation, to check that your vision for it is aligned with theirs and that the ideas you'd be bringing to it sit well with them, which might sometimes mean suggesting a, you know, a turn that they hadn't expected, or doing something quite radical, but it has to be, you know, with their absolute kind of buy-in and kind of readiness and, you know, being up for the challenge. And, you know, I think sort of sense checking someone's stamina is another thing that I try to do early, because some things, you know, particularly on submission, some things come to you and the work has been extensively workshopped on a course and through a writer's group, and the writer's done like maybe three drafts with their agent. And if you feel like you're ready to like jump in and go five more rounds with them, and they're at the point where they can't see the wood for the trees and just, you know, don't have the kind of energy or enthusiasm to bring to that, then maybe that's going to be a mismatch too. But anyway, I like to have read the whole thing straight through. I then read through very carefully. What I try to do is what, I mean, I say what you're supposed to do. I don't think there's any right way of doing these things. What I try to do is focus on the big picture first, and worry about the details later. But I find it often just all happens together, and that's partly because I'm quite nerdy and detail oriented, and if I spot something small that might need tweaking, I flag it at that time in case I forget, or just because I'm there. But also what I find very interesting about editing is that often, you know, what seems like quite a big revision to plot or character, say, can often be fixed in, you know, adding a line to a paragraph in a key chapter, or making sure that somebody's intentions are either clearer or less obvious at a key moment. So often I sort of see those big things and the small things as being quite interrelated anyway. But anyway, I love to edit on paper, partly because I feel like visually it helps my brain more. I also just enjoy it more. I find track changes, it's a bit like marking up a legal document. Also, to me, striking out someone's paragraph in track changes feels really harsh and final, and, you know, scoring it through with red lines. Whereas somehow, you know, crossing it out in pen and putting a little note as to why you're suggesting it, it still feels like a suggestion. And that's the other thing that's sort of important to clarify up front is that, you know, you might be doing a lot on the page or coming back with a lot of ideas, but everything you're coming back with is a suggestion, not an instruction, unless it's really, really serious.
We wanted to draw your attention to our crowdfunding page on Patreon. If you've been enjoying Always Take Notes, please do consider supporting us there. It helps us to keep the podcast going.
If you support us on Patreon, you can get a great selection of rewards, including a shout out on the show and a selection of successful magazine pitches. Thanks again for supporting Always Take Notes. Could we track back to the beginning of your career and just some of the chronological moves that you made? We saw that you, after university, got an internship at the Blake Friedman Literary Agency. How did that come about and how did things develop from that initial foray?
So I had graduated from university and gone back home to Dorset, where there is no publishing scene, and I got a job in the local bookshop, which was Ottica's, which doesn't exist anymore because it was taken, it was a chain that was taken over by Waterstones, and I was working in the bookshop, and I knew, or I thought I knew, that I wanted to work in publishing, in that I didn't really know anything about publishing, but I knew that I wanted to do something that was connected with books and writing, and that seemed the obvious first port of call. And I mean, I'm sort of glad that I was so naive about it and I didn't know how difficult it was to get into or how competitive, because it might have put me off trying. But I just wrote off lots of letters on spec to all kinds of publishing companies and literary agencies. I just got the Writers and Artists yearbook with my staff discount and made my way through the list. Didn't even occur to me to ask for work experience. I didn't know anything about it. Didn't occur to me to look at their website and see if they actually had any jobs. I just wrote off to all these people, most of whom understandably ignored me. But I got a letter back from Carol Blake, the literary agent, with her big looping signature. I think I've still got that letter in a box somewhere, offering me 2 weeks' work experience. And so I kind of went off for that 2 weeks' work experience. And I don't know, I still remember my family all like waving me off like I was off to seek my fortune. And I was like, I'll be back in 2 weeks. And I loved working there. I mean, she was so brilliant and generous and just an extraordinary person. And that agency were particularly good at giving young people a chance through work experience. I mean, this was back at the time where work experience placements were unpaid. And so they were largely the preserve of people who either lived in London or had friends in London or could afford to work unpaid, which I could not really, but I managed to do this 2 weeks, and I was staying on somebody's futon. And at the end of the 2 weeks, they needed some extra help. And Carol asked if I, you know, could stay and do some more work experience. And I said, well, I'd love to, I've loved doing this, but I haven't got any money and I don't live here and I can't do it. And she was just very pragmatic about it and said, well, we'll pay you, which at that time was really extraordinary and not something that most other people would have done. And I stayed for 3 months on a kind of sub-minimum wage, but it was enough to kind of get a shared flat and, you know, cobble together a living. And I, yeah, was there for 3 months doing all kinds of things, you know, opening big sacks of post because all the unsolicited submissions they got were in the mail at that time, and, you know, helping out with everything and sitting at the assistant's desks when people were away. And I don't know, it was all still quite old fashioned. I mean, it was nearly 20 years ago. I mean, describing it sounds like it was 50 years ago, but she used to dictate letters into a dictaphone, and then I would have to like put on those little headphones and the tape recorder would be linked up to a sort of foot pedal, and I'd have to type up these letters based on her dictation. Although I didn't know who any of these people were or how to spell their names or their companies. So I would give her back the letters in this sort of big leather bound book, you know, with all the sheets divided with blotting paper, and then I get them all back because I'd like misheard or misspelled things. But she was incredibly patient and generous. And I mean, that literary agency still are really, really good at supporting young people at the start of their careers and, you know, properly look after people. And that was a really wonderful experience. And I was applying to lots of assistant jobs in publishing and getting rejected from lots of assistant jobs. And at one point I said to her, oh, I wonder if I could just at lunchtime show you the list of people that I'm writing to and see if you've got any other suggestions for people I could try. And she, you know, took me out for a three-course lunch at the local pub, and just, it was just quite extraordinary. But anyway, I think I was rejected from 9 or 10 interviews. And then finally, probably just at the point where I was kind of running out of hope and money, I got a job in the rights department at Penguin and started there in March 2003, I think it was.
And how did your career progress then from working at Penguin to then going to Hamish Hamilton and then on to Simon & Schuster? I'm aware we're covering sort of 4 years there, but it's quite a rapid sort of ascent.
I guess. So I was an assistant in the rights department for 2 years and I really enjoyed it and I had a really nice boss. And she could tell that my heart wasn't totally in it. And I did remember her, when I was still quite new, saying, if you ever want to move on, I would much rather you just told me about it than kept pretending that the boiler had broken or you had a dentist appointment and snooping around, because I will be able to tell. And it was sort of quite helpful knowing that up front. And so I sort of realized that the next step in the rights department, you know, wouldn't be for me if I'd set my heart on working in editorial, which I'd realized was kind of the best fit for me personally and the best kind of way I felt to have a job that was much more connected with authors and words and the creative side, even though having a grounding in rights is very helpful. And Simon Prosser, the publisher of Hamish Hamilton, who's a great, inspiring publisher, was looking for an assistant 2 years later. And my boss, who was, as I say, very supportive, also quite scary, strongly encouraged him to interview me for it. And I got the job. So then I had 2 years working as his assistant, which was the most amazing experience because of the incredible list of distinguished writers that he published. And, you know, 1 year that I was working there, his authors won the Booker and the Women's Prize, which was then the Orange Prize, and the Whitbread, which is, well, which then became the Costa and has today been announced as the Cafe Nero Prize. So long may it continue. And that was an extraordinary experience. And then I was approached and asked to interview for a commissioning editor job at Simon & Schuster. And I went because I knew that you should always take the coffee or whatever they say, take the meeting. And sort of to my surprise, because I was still quite inexperienced, was offered that job and just realized that as much as I loved working at Hamish Hamilton, which was really my dream job, I probably wasn't going to get to commission books there or take my next step there because there just wasn't the space. And I realised I sort of had to take the leap. So I became a commissioning editor at Simon & Schuster, which was a very different company in a very different environment, but was a really good place to learn because I was just, you know, given quite, there were lots of books that I had to edit or publish on someone else's behalf. But in terms of commissioning, you know, I wasn't given a very clear or strategic brief. You know, they were all very nice to work for, but I don't know, the company was in a different place than the multi-award winning place that it's in now. But actually, it was amazing. And, you know, I still had a lot of support. And I realised that I had to be quite resourceful because I didn't have lots of experience for those sort of most literary books or the books that I, you know, the most desirable books. I was up in competition with editors who were twice my age or more, had decades of experience, were offering opportunities at, you know, distinguished literary houses, which is not to say that Simon & Schuster isn't a distinguished house, but it didn't have much literary publishing at that time. And I was losing those books all the time. And I realized that I had to have a really open mind about the kind of book that I could take on and that I had to play to my own strengths. And so it really opened my eyes to other kinds of books. I don't think I was ever a snob, and I've always loved books that are sort of plot driven and warm and, you know, emotive. But I'd never read a thriller before. And then I was given one to edit, and it sort of opened my eyes to what thriller writing could do. And so it made me a broader and a better reader, I think. And it also made me think, okay, I haven't got all of the experience that some of these other people can offer. And there's lots of things that are, you know, not working to my advantage here, but, you know, what can I bring? And like lots of kind of people at the start of their careers, I thought, well, I can, you know, I know what people my age like to read, and I can give a lot of time and connect really well with debut novelists who are also in their mid-20s. And so I, you know, I tried to use that as a strength, and that helped.
Could you tell us about your subsequent move to Picador and perhaps the experience of these two sort of smash hits that you were involved in? So The Miniaturist and then This Is Going to Hurt. Tell us about how that move came about, and then particularly the experience with those two books.
Well, after 4 years at Simon & Schuster, I'd been promoted in that time and I'd learned a lot. The opportunity came up at Picador. It was another approach, although there was quite a rigorous interview process that I went through for that job, and I was absolutely thrilled to get it. I loved the Picador list, and it felt like a really exciting opportunity. And so there were still some authors and books that I was very sad to leave behind, but yeah, I was really excited to have that opportunity. And so I went, and I was tasked with finding fiction at the commercial end of a literary list. So Picador had a great, not only a great literary tradition in being the publisher of Don DeLillo and Cormac McCarthy and countless other greats, but also had been the home of The Lovely Bones and Room and Bridget Jones's Diary, and they wanted more books in that vein. And so that was my remit there. And I sort of started doing some nonfiction kind of by accident by publishing one memoir that did well. And so I started, and then as soon as, you know, you publish one thing that works, people send you lots more things in that vein. So after publishing Mrs. Hemingway, I got sent a lot more novels about the women behind famous men. And after Kathy Rensenbrink's The Last Act of Love, I got sent a lot more memoir. And The Miniaturist was a novel that I acquired a few years into my time there. I think it must have come out in 2015, so I must have bought it in 2013 or 2014. Sorry to be hazy on dates. And that book was, I mean, it was acquired in a big auction. It was in the run-up to the London Book Fair of that year. It felt like an absolute breath of fresh air, but also like a classic in the making, in that in some ways it was, you know, powered by good old-fashioned storytelling and reminiscent of not much that was being published at that time, but of books, you know, like Rose Tremaine's writing or Deborah Mogger's writing, or losing track now of the comparison titles that I would have used at the time. But it also felt so fresh and so modern. It's so atmospheric. It was like looking at a painting. Completely adored it. It was a very competitive auction. And I was thrilled when we got it. And you could tell that Jessie Burton was a future star.
A theme of the podcast is that people can't always tell why things become a big hit. But it sounds like from the off, you had a sense that this was about to be a big smash.
We hoped it was. I mean, you always hope something that will work. And the maddening thing about publishing is that most things are out of your control. It was definitely partly as a result of being acquired in such a big auction, and partly because we all really, really believed in the book. We did everything we could to, engage booksellers really early, to give it a really prominent place on our list, to, you know, design that beautiful cover, which was actually, you know, created by miniature artists. I mean, not artists who are tiny little people, but people who specialize in miniatures and model making. It was a book that sort of gathered its own momentum because the people we sent it to for quotes really loved it, and readers and started falling in love with it and talking about it on social media, and Waterstones and the independent bookshops really got behind it in a big way. So it had a lot of, you know, goodwill and energy behind it, in addition to everything that we were doing and driving behind the scenes, because I've been involved in other books where you put in just as much work and you don't get very much back, and that can be heartbreaking. But it just really struck a chord with people, and I think with lots of different types of readers. I think one of the things that I loved most about, you know, after it became successful and Jessie was doing so many events all around the country, the people coming up to her at the signing tables were a real mixture of like silver-haired ladies in book groups who, you know, bought it in the independent bookshop in their market town and discussed it, you know, in their book club and, you know, passed it on to their friends. But it was also teenage girls who had taken the sort of feminism of this 18-year-old heroine, and, you know, some of the more modern themes that the book explores, albeit in, you know, a way that completely transports you in a very authentic way to 17th century Amsterdam. Yeah, so it struck a chord with so many different kinds of reader. It won awards, it was very well reviewed, and it felt like a dream. You wish that it could always be like that. And in the aftermath, I mean, you said, you know, people are always curious about why things work. In the aftermath of a big hit like that, there is a little while where everyone thinks that you have the secret and that you figured it all out. And people are sort of asking how it happened or why it happened. And you see this as well with writers whose books have broken out when it's time for questions. And at an event, the writers in the audience kind of want they don't quite want, expect a step-by-step plan of like, how do I become a big best-selling author? But it's kind of at the heart of the question. And the answer is, you know, largely an unsatisfying one about, you know, luck, timing. You know, yes, of course, it's about a brilliant book and an amazing, hardworking author, but there are also brilliant books and amazing, hardworking authors who don't reach the same readership.
Could you tell us about Adam Kay now? Is it right that you approached him and he was initially reluctant?
That is right. I mean, I don't know how long he would have stayed reluctant, but I did. I'd gone to the Edinburgh Festival for the book festival, and I had a bit of time to kind of do my own thing. And, you know, I love comedy and The Fringe. And I'd ask for suggestions of, you know, what should I see if I've got some time when I'm up there. And one of the shows that I'd seen getting lots of, you know, very heartfelt recommendations, including from Mark Watson, who's the writer and comedian who I was publishing at the time and who's a friend of Adam's, was this show that Adam had written, you know, largely in support of the junior doctor strike that was happening at that time. And I went along to see it, and it was in this tiny little room, had a really inappropriate title, because I think he was the show on after somebody much more mild-mannered and enjoyed, you know, the mix-up of tone. And it just completely blew me away. It was him and his keyboard, and he was reading from these diaries that he'd written at the time. And that was partly what made it so effective, as well as it being just incredibly funny. It was feeling like you were getting the kind of real-time experience of everything that he'd scribbled down, you know, after all of those long shifts and missed weekends and, you know, around the edges of having no time to process some of the awe-inspiring or terrible or disgusting things that he'd seen on the wards. And it, you know, felt like you were getting that in a very kind of present and firsthand way. I mean, it sort of reminded me, even though they're so different, of Nina Stibbe's letters in Love, Nina, the fact that so much of the enjoyment of that is knowing that those were written in that way at that time. But it was incredibly funny, and it was hilarious for about, you know, 50 minutes of the 1 hour show. And then towards the end, he tells the story of the terrible thing that happened that made him realize that he couldn't be a doctor anymore. And I think, you know, everyone in the room was crying. And then he ended the show with a sort of rallying cry for the junior doctors, and seeing that, you know, going through that with him really brought home why it matters. And I think I'm sure everyone who entered that room knew that the junior doctors deserved support and that it mattered. But when it's made personal in that way, that's incredibly effective. And that still sort of remains for me the kind of nonfiction that I want to do is, you know, something that is very personal and subjective, but illuminates something much bigger. Anyway, I came out kind of shaken and in need of a gin and tonic, but immediately, you know, said to Mark, like, that was really incredible. It should be a book. Adam should make it into a book. And he introduced us. And Adam, you know, Adam was very nice and friendly. And he said, you know, I've never really wanted to write a book. And I said, well, please think about it. And so we arranged to meet after the festival. And we met up and we talked about, you know, how it might become a book, because the show had been readings of the diary interspersed with comedy songs, which obviously, like, you can't replicate in print. And so we talked about how it might kind of, you know, retain its authenticity, but what sort of structure or framework it might need around it. And he worked up a proposal and we talked about it. And then fortunately, because of the way it had come about, I was the only publisher it was sent to. And I'm very glad also that the colleagues that I showed it to at the time kind of trusted that it would make a brilliant book on the basis of, you know, relatively few pages. There were the diaries and, you know, a sense of how it would take shape, but they put their faith in it on some very early material. And then, yeah, we worked together some more. I mean, he went off and, you know, I still remember really clearly reading the first draft of that book and laughing, crying, you know, being kind of shocked to the core by some of the stuff that's in there and just thinking, this is going to be absolutely brilliant. But none of us in our wildest dreams could ever have predicted, you know, the kind of phenomenon it became. And I'd love to say that we set that up and orchestrated that perfectly, but of course, you know, loads of that is bookshops and readers and magic.
I remember seeing that show at Edinburgh as well, and I've also read the book and felt that it captured that same mix of humour and heartbreak. We're coming towards the end of our time, so a final question from me. You've mentioned the importance of mentoring in some of your other interviews. Who has mentored you throughout your career, and what advice did they impart? And sort of as a second part to that, do you now also mentor other people?
So many people have mentored me. I mean, I've been lucky to have worked for people consistently. I've been very lucky in the bosses that I've had throughout my career who have been generous and trusting and offered advice, but also given me quite a lot of room to try things and make mistakes. And I think that's really important. And, you know, I'm quite control freaky by nature. And so, you know, and I've taken a step away from management quite consciously because of the kind of career that I wanted to have. But I hope that for the, I kind of co-manage an assistant. And then I realized during, you know, the later part of my time at Picador that I didn't particularly enjoy managing or feel especially good at it, but I love my mentoring. And because Orion is now, because I'm now at Orion, which is part of Hachette, there are plenty of opportunities to get involved in mentoring. In addition to the bosses that I've had who've been great mentors, one of the things that I have really, really appreciated is how many generous, wise people there are in publishing, full stop, but particularly among the other women that I've known and worked with for years. And one of the types of mentoring that I especially valued was having come back to work after maternity leave, and which for me personally was quite a big shakeup of, you know, okay, I've been doing this job for quite a long time. I've worked out like how to do it for myself in terms of keeping these hours and managing my time in this particular way, and, you know, having quite a lot of independence and autonomy, and I need to learn how to do all of that now on a different time scale and with a different set of priorities. And I found that quite hard, and I was really grateful for the way that so many women that I had known for years, including lots of women that I had didn't even know especially well, kind of really stepped up to offer advice or kindness around that time. And the one thing that has stuck with me kind of the most from the mentoring and support that I had around sort of deciding on the move that eventually became the job that I have now, when I was having my kind of worry that I couldn't take on the big boss's job because of all the things that I wasn't and didn't know. Our sales director at Picador, a brilliant woman called Christine Jones, said to me, "You don't have to do it all and you don't have to do any of it by yourself." And I think about that still all the time. I may yet get it tattooed on my arm because I need reminding of it all the time. But I'm very grateful for that particular piece of advice.
And a final question from me is about the intersection between commercial and literary. You've talked about an interest in books that span that. I mean, do you think that they're useful in terms of classification or taxonomy, or is it, you know, just that whole piece of that thing?
I think they're useful to an extent in the industry. I don't think those terms mean anything to readers. I can really enjoy the kind of publishing that I do, which is at that midpoint where commercial meets literary, and, you know, being able to forge an imprint around books that are both commercial and literary, which I think is all everyone really wants anyway. I think there's a lot of energy is sometimes poured into making that distinction. But actually, everybody wants books that are really good and reach lots of readers, which is all I really think of it. I don't personally find it helpful to kind of classify books on a sort of sliding scale of how highbrow they are. And I also think most readers, like most people, have quite eclectic tastes that, you know, span a wider range of genres and types of thing than we often give them credit for. I mean, like many people, I'm addicted to Succession, but also love The Bake Off. And, you know, too. And I think when it comes to books, very few people are, you know, rigidly loyal to one genre and don't enjoy more of a mix.
Well, that's a fitting note to end on. Thank you so much, Francesca, for your time, and wishing you all the best with all your projects going forward.
Thank you.
That was the Always Take Notes interview with Francesca Main. You can find her on Twitter at Francesca Main, and Phoenix Books is also on Twitter at Phoenix_BKS. Hello, it's us again. Simon, what was your takeaway from the interview with Francesca?
I was really interested in hearing about the experience of publishing these sort of mega hits, and particularly with This Is Gonna Hurt, how it began with, you know, her speaking to Adam Kay, and then it kind of expanded into this like phenomenal size thing. So always, we've had a lot of very successful authors talking about the experience of a big hit, but I thought really interesting to hear a publisher's perspective from that. And just also interesting to hear, I think as ever, kind of what things look like from the publisher's side of the fence, as well as the authors. What about you?
Agree. I very much enjoyed talking about these two books in particular. I read The Miniaturist when I just finished university, and I remember it was the first book I'd read for pleasure in many a year. So it was great to hear about the genesis of that book. And on the smash hits, I thought it was interesting as well that she shared the idea that it was still quite elusive what it was that made them take off in the way that they did. So goes to show that, you know, you can't second guess yourself. Might as well just write the book and see what happens.
It's like that line, what is it, that old sort of Hollywood line that like no one has a clue or something like that, that like no one knows why things work and don't work. Anyway, Rachel, what have you been up to?
I have just returned from a lovely 4-day trip in Brittany with James, my partner, and his siblings and their partners. So I did a bit of reading. I read Soldier Sailor by Claire Kilroy, who's an Irish author, which was a sort of slim but very powerful novel about motherhood. I've also been watching a fantastic Australian comedy show called Colin from Accounts, which I'm a bit late to and everyone had been telling me to watch, but it's very, very funny and charming and silly. So I would recommend anyone watching that if they want 27 minutes of light relief in their evening. How about you?
Who doesn't want that? I, as we were saying off air, I've been doing a lot of physical training because I'm on this sort of 11-month ramp up for this event that I have to do for my current book project in the Alps next year, which has been good, although I need to work out how to deal with my vastly increased appetite. And then in terms of Matters Cultural, I am reading a book by a Swiss poet called Maurice Chappa about the Haute Route, which is this ski mountaineering route that I'm writing about, which is interesting, although his French is like very baroque and quite difficult. And then in terms of TV, I've been watching this, this is slightly meta actually, but we have interviewed for the podcast the novelist Lee Child. We haven't put it out yet, but I've been watching the Amazon adaptation of his Jack Reacher novels, which is fun. It stars this enormous actor called Alan Ritchson. So that's been the rest of my cultural diet.
Excellent. A varied diet, indeed.
It is. It is a properly varied diet. Anyway, this has been Always Take Notes, hosted by me, Simon Akam.
And me, Rachel Lloyd.
Our producer and social media editor is Artemis Irvin. Our score is by Jess Danheiser, and our graphic design is by James Edgar.
If you'd like to follow us on social media, we're on Instagram at Always Take Notes, on Twitter at Take Notes Always. Our crowdfunding page on Patreon is under Always Take Notes. And if you'd like to leave a review on iTunes or get in touch with us via our website, please do.
Many thanks. Goodbye.